Good evening, and thank you for tuning in to York's Political Mashup. This is episode 3 of season 5. This evening I'm joined by initially just Toby and Joe, but later on a Green Party representative will also be joining us. So I'm going to start off with Toby. Toby, would you like to introduce yourself?
Hi, I'm Toby. I'm a first year. How are you doing? You alright?
Yep. Thank you, Toby. And Toby's representing the York Labour Club. And we have Joe. Joe, would you like to say hello? Joe's been on a few times before.
Yeah, hi. Nice to speak again. I'm really sorry if I sound a bit weird. I've got a weird thing in my headphones, so I can hear myself like two seconds back. So I'm sorry if something sounds weird for you here. So I'm representing the York Tories. So it's nice to be with you again.
Thank you, Joe. So we're now going to start off with the most obvious topic of conversation at the moment in the news, which is Boris Johnson's roadmap out of the current lockdown. So I'll start off with Toby. Toby, do you think the plan which was unveiled last night, is it too ambitious or too cautious? Do you think that Johnson should have released the stay-at-home message, or is he right to continue telling people to stay at home until late March?
I think the problem we have when we ask if it's too ambitious or too cautious is it massively depends on what risk we're willing to have. Like, what number of cases, what number of hospitalizations or deaths are we willing to have in order to open up the economy? It reminded me a lot of the Christmas lockdown mixing, and that everyone was looking forward to a 5-day Christmas on the 8th of December. And then we rolled it back and rolled it back with Tier 4 until it was only one day, and there was a lot of hope and it was taken away. But what I think is most interesting about this easing of lockdown is, in order to move on to the next stage of it, the requirements that have to be met are these 4 tests. And there's a 68-page document the government have released on their website, and they use words such as sufficiently, as successfully, and surge and unsustainable pressure. But they don't have any dates associated to this. And Johnson can claim he's using data over dates, but there's no data there. And Johnson's got previous on this too. You'll remember the stay alert 1 to 5 scale from the summer. Not only did the government set the level at the time to 3.5, which when you're in charge of the scale is bonkers, but it was abandoned within 2 months because it didn't work. So I think the real worry we have is this. What data is going to drive the easing of the lockdown? Because there's some massive risks involved. I'm sure we'll go on to the risk of opening up all schools on the 8th of March.
I mean, you mentioned a concern about the data, and that seems to echo what Steve Baker said. I mean, Steve Baker has spoken about how the government's plan for lockdown is based on modelling rather than data. But is there not a symbiotic relationship between the modelling and data? How would you articulate your position in relation to what Steve Baker has said?
I mean, Steve Baker's plan's really weird, because of course the data is based on the modelling, because the events haven't happened yet. For example, if you look at the impact of schools, you can't evaluate the impact opening schools will have on COVID until you've opened up the schools. And there are epidemiologists, there are statistical mathematicians for whom successfully modelling diseases are their lifetime's work. They're calculating the risk, calculating the likely effects. And if Baker is making the argument we should open everything up now because cases are currently falling, that's ridiculous, because the reason cases are falling are because we're in lockdown. The relationship between modelling and data doesn't make sense. The modelling is trying to predict what the data will show us.
Do you think the 4 weeks in between each stage, therefore, is a good idea in terms of the fact that you're not going to get the data until that 4-week period after that 4-week period is necessary to see the effect of the easing of each restriction?
I just think it massively depends what data you're looking for and what data you're acceptable with. And that's why I bring up the 4 tests. They're referred to repeatedly, but it doesn't actually link to any physical data. And when we look at Johnson, Johnson's a bellwether prime minister. He likes taking decisions that are popular, whether they're the right decisions or not. And the real risk in this plan isn't the plan itself, it's the people, and specifically the Prime Minister in charge of it. Because the real worry is he'll massively change the dates depending on public mood and his MPs, depending on what he thinks they want them to do.
Okay, thank you, Toby. Let's go to Joe. Joe, I mean, The Guardian has spoken about how this is a very big gamble, as it's extremely reliant on the success of the vaccines. Is there any way Johnson could have avoided producing a rollout plan which wasn't heavily reliant on whether the vaccines work? And The Guardian proposes a zero COVID strategy. Do you think it's possible that we're going to be able to live in a society in the near future where there's no COVID whatsoever?
I'm not sure that's possible, even with vaccines. I mean, it's got like 95% rate of people getting antibodies. And it's kind of, in Israel, it was about 95% drop in people going to like ICU, I think. So even with vaccines, there's no kind of, well, there's a chance that the COVID will live on, but it won't be as serious. I think we'll just have to learn to live with it. Even with a no COVID strategy that New Zealand and Australia had, they still had to go into lockdowns when people from foreign countries came in. And I think, was it Perth that went into lockdown? I'm not sure. But still, when there's international travel, there is... there's always going to be that risk of people coming in with COVID and giving it to a security guard or a cleaner or something like that. So I think that the vaccine way is the only way to do it, because otherwise there's far larger risks of kind of COVID being reintroduced into society.
Okay, and I mean, Toby's touched upon the plan. What do you make of this plan? Is it... are you disappointed that a lot of the dates seem to be the provisional dates, as Toby sort of highlighted, are quite far into the future? And do you think that this plan is going to be significantly altered between now and the dates which have been set out?
I hope not. I'd love to go and see the Euros in a pub, or like if you can get tickets to go and see them. And I think, I mean, it'd be like 96 on steroids. I mean, I'm not old enough to see it, to see the 96, but I'd love to see something like that in this country, and like, it'd be amazing. But I think it was about right. Opening it too quickly does have inherent risks with... basically not vaccinating enough people. But obviously keeping it too long will have really detrimental effects in society, especially young people as well. They've been kept out of schools, they're being with massive like mental health problems as well. So I do think that it was just about right where it balances those two risks. And I pray so hard. I'm not religious, but I pray that we go and we keep these dates and the kind of I mean, June 21st is going to be a good day.
And I mean, before we go back to Toby, a senior Tory, Mark Harper, who's the head of the backbencher COVID recovery group, he said that all the legal restrictions should be lifted by April, as this is the point at which the top nine priority groups, all being well, would have been vaccinated by. So what's your thinking behind the argument that this plan is too cautious, and every day that goes by in which there are unnecessary restrictions, more businesses are going to suffer and potentially go under?
I mean, by April, most things will be open anyway, so I do think that the lockdown officially lasts into the June 21st won't make a massive difference. I mean, it might do to a couple of nightclubs, but on balance and on the kind of risk, I do think that it is sensible. And also, we're kind of waiting for the new 5-minute COVID tests that can be done. So, like, nightclubs can be more safe and kind of COVID-free, because as we've seen in South Korea, COVID was spread in a nightclub. So I do think that that is probably part of their reasoning, but I do think it is probably sensible.
Okay, thank you, Joe. And Toby, the Imperial College London has released a set of data in terms of how they believe what the numbers are going to look like in terms of deaths if we go along the plan that has been released. And their most optimistic set of assumptions forecast that 30,000 more COVID deaths will occur. And if the restrictions are released more quickly, then this could rise to 100,000. What would you say to those who argue that we should just remain in lockdown right up until the summer, until all adults have been vaccinated?
I think remaining in lockdown indefinitely is a very dangerous situation, mainly because of the impact that would have on people's mental health. But I do think there are much easier ways of releasing lockdown, but they've been taken away from us because of the failures of these governments. So if you look at the way we're releasing lockdown, The Guardian are right in the way they're saying that Johnson's lockdown relies too heavily on vaccines succeeding. But the reason we're in this situation is because of the failure of track and trace. Boris Johnson promised the country it would have a world-beating test and trace system in place by June, accompanied by a contact tracing app that would also be a global leader. But track and trace has been a cronyistic, corrupt disaster. In November, Sage stated that the government needed at least an 80% success rate with track and trace for community testing to be worthwhile. And for the last 2 weeks of January, according to iSense, after investing £22 billion of government funds, the government estimated end-to-end effectiveness is at 18%, which is a mere 62% off the target. So when we look at lockdowns going on indefinitely, the reason we're in this situation is because lots of the alternatives of leaving lockdown have been taken away from us because of incompetence.
Joe, how would you respond to what Toby said about the track and trace system?
I completely disagree. The problem with the track and trace system is that it was done by the government initially and not by the private sector. And when it was done by the private sector, it was the best one in Europe. Way better than the Germans, I think. So the problem was that it wasn't that it was managed by the government, and the NHS has got an incredibly bureaucratic system for things like this. I think they've got two. There's NHSX and there's another one that deal with all the tech. And this is the reason for the failure, because they couldn't do it, and they tried. And Apple and Google tried to help them. And they refused it. And then they got into inevitable problems. And then they basically had to get bailed out by the private sector. So I just think that that argument is wrong. And look, other countries have gone into lockdown with, like, Israel. And, yeah, they didn't have, like, a track and trace system. And there's countries like Germany that have a worse track and trace system than us. And they... Sorry, the thing's being a bit weird. My microphone, I can hear myself like 2 seconds afterwards, so it's quite disconcerting. But Germany and France and Spain had a worse track and trace system than we did, and then not in lockdown. So I'm not sure it was purely down to that.
But I think I was going to say the argument wasn't that the private sector shouldn't have done it, or the NHS shouldn't have done it. It wasn't about who was in charge of it. The argument was this government has tried to set up a test and trace system. They've tried to do contact tracing. £22 billion has gone into it. 70% of contracts were directly awarded without competition, and they failed. I wasn't saying who should do it, and I wasn't saying the government... Well, the government clearly have chosen the wrong way, but I wasn't criticising that. I was just criticising the failure as a whole. Because if we had a more successful one, lockdown could be alleviated earlier.
Let's move this conversation onto schools, because then we can get back into a debate about that. So, Toby, I mean, touching upon this is a good place to move on to discussion about schools. The guidance which has been given out in terms of schools is that masks are going to be worn in secondary schools. Do you think do you think that's too little too late in terms of why shouldn't the government have introduced this earlier? I mean, countries like such as France made it compulsory for masks to be worn in schools a long time ago. And secondly, how do you think our track and trace system will impact the effect of children going back to school come March?
Well, I think all of primary school and secondary schools going back on the 8th of March is a massive risk. That's 10 million people who are going to be mixing in their quite big communities. And I think you can see that in what the scientists are saying. You have the chair of the Global Public Health at the University of Edinburgh suggesting that schools opening isn't the problem, it's keeping them open when you have cases because of the massive bubbles that go home. You have the epidemiologists at Queen Mary Uni of London who suggest primary school children are 2 times more likely than the adults to be the first case in a household. And once infected, they were 2 times more likely to transmit than adults. And you have Sir Mark Walport, the former chief scientific advisor, who said secondary school children were 7 times more likely to introduce COVID-19 into a household than other members of a household. And so I think the issue you have when you haven't vaccinated all the teachers and the support staff in the half-term break, which Keir Starmer was saying we should, and you have 7 times more likely for secondary school kids to bring COVID-19 into a household, it's a massive risk. And when we don't have track and trace working effectively, we won't be able to see the impact of that risk because we don't have good enough community testing to evaluate the decisions, look at the data and make decisions. And when our easing of lockdown isn't based on specific data, it's based on meaningless platitudes, that's a really risky situation.
Before we move to Joe, do you think Starmer's proposal in terms of vaccinating teachers was realistic, considering that the majority of teachers aren't in that vulnerable category or high age bracket of 80s and 70s? Because at the end of the day, the government would have had to have chosen to decrease the amount of... They could have ramped up their vaccination programme, but that's unlikely. So do you think it was a case of the government having to choose between either vaccinating teachers or vaccinating less of the elderly? Do you think that's the dilemma that they had to confront?
I think if you look at the numbers, to vaccinate all teachers and support staff in the half-term break would have taken 2 days. So when we look at the comparison between elderly people not getting the vaccine, it's not that big of a diversion. And when you do have the stats we have about COVID in schools, with 7 times more likely for secondary schools and at least 2 times more likely for primary schools, I think the impact those teachers can have, having had the vaccine, less likely to pass it on to other people, you're protecting those people. I think it would have been worth it.
Do you think, therefore, schools should continue their online learning for the entirety of the rest of the year? Or are you just proposing that there should be a more gradual going back to school in terms of the secondary and primary?
I think a more gradual approach would be... I think maybe, I'm not entirely sure. I just think it's disappointing that we're not going to be able to properly evaluate the risks and the data associated to it. I think it's a big risk. If it comes off, it'll be great because we need to get kids back as soon as possible. But if it doesn't, then it is a huge dilemma.
Okay. Joe, what is your thinking in terms of whether the government has made the right decision in allowing secondary and primary school pupils to go back on the same date? And what do you think about the fact that the government has been slow in terms of it making it compulsory for masks to be worn in secondary schools?
I think that most schools have made it compulsory anyway, so it's a bit pointless really. My cousin, who's in school down south, she's had to have done it for since the start of term. So there's no... It's acting after the horse has bolted, really. And same with my school that I went to. With getting schools back, I think it's really important. My mum's a teacher. My brothers are both in exam years. I see the damage it's doing to them, the lockdown, the online learning. It's just, we need to go back. And the school's not just about learning and sitting and cramming some facts into your head. It's about socialising and learning those person-to-person skills that are so important in real life and outside of the school. And they just not quite got that. And it's sad to see, really. And we've kind of, unfortunately, had to throw that generation of those cheer groups under the bus because, for the good of the rest of society. But we need to repay that by getting them back into school so they're getting face-to-face teachers and getting the education that they need and deserve.
Okay, thank you, Joe. Before we move on to a different topic, Toby, what would you like to see Rishi Sunak introduce in the budget next week? As Keir Starmer has spoken about how there should be more support for those who are self-isolating and who choose not to self-isolate because they don't have enough financial support. He said that people were in particular scared, in his own words. So what would you like to see in the budget next week?
I think there are three things that Sunak could introduce immediately, which would be good. So number one, I think he cannot cut this £20 temporary universal credit uplift. 1 in 6 new universal credit claimants have been forced to skip meals. So we have a situation in which our welfare state has been cut to such an extent it doesn't provide 3 meals a day, and this might be cut further. And if Sunak had any empathy, he wouldn't. I think number two, economic support for those who are isolating has to come in. We're approaching a year into a pandemic, and the government has still not announced universal sick pay for those who are forced to isolate. And number three, he has to implement an immediate pay rise for all key workers, or at the very least, reverse the public sector pay freeze implemented in November. Starmer is calling for £10 an hour for all carers, and an increase higher than inflation for all public workers, and that's the very least Sunak should implement. He talks a good game, but freezing key worker pay when he went out and clapped every Thursday is an insult and a return to austerity. But mainly, I'd love to see Sunak replicate the success of the vaccine task force in other areas. Interest rates were at an all-time low, and now is the time to borrow and implement radical changes. What if we took the same approach we have to vaccine procurement and rollout to homelessness, housing reform, pupil premium funding, specialist teachers, or good jobs for working-class communities left behind? We have a fantastic template now, how to introduce successful policy reform, and now is the time to do it and to go big.
So, with the changes you've proposed, you're suggesting that we should increase the borrowing even further in order to fund the higher wages in the public sector?
Massively. I think it's going to benefit us in the long term. You're going to have that multiplier effect. More people are going to go out and spend. We're trying to get the economy back moving. Interest rates are at an all-time low. We've already borrowed so much. Now is the cheapest time to borrow, and it's time to invest in our country.
Okay. Let's bring in Pads. Pads, can you hear us?
Yeah, I can hear you.
Okay, Pads has joined us, the Green Party member. So, Pads, we're just talking about Rishi Sunak and his budget and the latest lockdown plan. Would you like to give your thoughts, just quite succinctly, on what you make of Boris's plan for easing the lockdown and the path to freedom, as he labelled it, and also what you would like to see in Rishi Sunak's budget next week?
Just on the budget, I'd like to echo the last point about borrowing. I think it would be good to have an injection of capital these times. It doesn't seem intuitive, but I think that could be a good response to the economic downturn we've seen over the last year. In terms of the relaxation of lockdown, I think it strikes a good balance. I think it's not too... It's not too ambitious, but I think obviously one of the things which it allows for is kind of is gaps between the major opening ups, like between retail, hospitality, for return to education. So I'm not too sure of science behind it, but I like the way it's very staggered and very sort of progressive, and I suppose more cautious than not cautious, which I think is the best way to, the best approach to take.
And we were just debating schools and their return, and there was differing positions and perspectives put forward by Joe and Toby. Do you think that it's right that schools, secondary and primary schools, are going to go back on the same date?
Yes, I do. I think it's good. I think the science supports that, from what I've read.
Okay, let's go to Joe now. Joe, what do you want to see in Rishi Sunak's budget next week?
I would love to see the free ports being announced. I'd love to see TESA becoming a free port. I think it would be really beneficial to the area. And I know the TESA mayor, Ben Houchen, is really, really keen on that issue. And I think that'll be really, really good, especially for these kind of left-behind communities. I'd love to also see tax cuts and cutting of red tape, so it's easy to set up businesses. Because then that will stimulate the economy afterwards, and kind of hopefully we'll have a boom in innovation after this, as people have had like time to be at home and think of some kind of business ideas and things like that. So hopefully that will happen. And lastly, I'd like to see a more kind of Estonian response to this pandemic, where we don't spend more than we get in. I mean, this pandemic is going to punish our children and grandchildren with the kind of massive burden of debt. And even though the interest rates are really kind of low now, what happens if they rise? We spend more now on purely just interest paying than we do for education, which is outrageous. And we need to kind of cut this debt. And I do believe that we need to kind of, we need to basically not spend more than we get. And that means that, I can hear myself now. I can hear myself without hearing myself 2 seconds later. That's weird. But basically what we need to do is we need to cut tap. Yeah, three things like the person from the Labour Club. We need to cut taxes. We need to announce free ports, and we need to commit to not spending more than we can get than we get in taxes. Cutting taxes, I believe, will actually raise revenue for the government. So therefore, I think that's a real positive, and I think that's what needs to be implemented.
Thank you, Joe. We're now going to move on to talking about Facebook, because we've spoken at length about the lockdown. Unfortunately, it's very typical of the news, the fact that before, in planning this show, Facebook hadn't reversed their decision, and then they just reversed it last night. But we can still talk about it because it's still relevant. We'll start with Pads maybe on this issue. So Pads, I'm sure you're aware that Facebook recently banned Australian news sites from posting in response to a proposed rollout of a news media bargaining code, which is currently before the Australian Senate. So the problem with this, the problem with the plans put forward, Facebook would have to negotiate with individual publishers. Do you think it was right that Facebook then retaliated by banning news content, and subsequently a large number of sites which weren't actually news in the formal sense, such as Kids Cancer Project and community pages, were also banned as a result?
No, I think it was a pretty aggressive move by Facebook there. I think we all benefit from having a wide range of smaller providers of news and information. I think the idea that one large or a small number of large organisations could almost monopolise that, I think it's quite scary. I think the Australian government took a brave stand when it did.
Do you think the UK should follow in the footsteps of Australia in introducing more robust legislation which deals with restricting Facebook, or do you think that would be counterproductive?
Well, I think it's a negotiation that every individual country will have to make with these giants, these tech giants, eventually. I suppose at some point the UK needs to ask itself that question. Whether or not now is the right time to do it is a different issue, I think.
Okay. Let's go to Toby on this one. I mean, Toby, first it'd be interesting to hear your thoughts on what you made of Facebook's move, but in the more general sense, do you think this shows the problem in which big tech companies present in terms of threatening democracy and freedom of speech and the ability of people online not to receive content which has been censored?
I mean, massively. I think the legislation is incredibly bold. I think it's incredibly brave for the Australian government. But I think it's slightly barking up the wrong tree. Big tech and climate change are obviously going to be the emerging issues in the coming decades, as currently both aren't being tackled or addressed in nearly the way they need to be, and the status quo is going to lead us to disaster. And I think this is why you had the ACCC finding an imbalance of power between tech firms and the media, because they saw that tech firms were dominating the media coverage, they were controlling what media was promoted, and because of the data harvesting that goes on from people like Facebook, they can control what media is promoted and what media is being shown to the users and creating those echo chambers. But I don't think this legislation forcing Facebook to pay for the product is really going to help that, especially if when Facebook removes itself from Australia and starts banning those news companies, you are restricting that free speech.
Facebook have since U-turned on the decision, and they said in response to into the rumours that the UK was considering something similar, that they already have negotiated individual contracts with individual publishers and pay tens of millions, in their words, to The Guardian, The Daily Mail and Channel 4 News. You mentioned that the legislation was very bold. Do you think part of the problem that governments are going to have with this legislation is that, firstly, in each different country, it's not going to be unified in terms of their response? And then it also might not appreciate the different complex contract Facebook is negotiating with different news outlets.
I think that's going to be a major problem. And I think when we tackle big tech universally, we need to have these international approaches. Because I think one of the big issues of big tech at the moment that seems to keep getting swept under the carpet is the ability of big tech to get around paying their taxes. It's offences that the Google chairman, Eric Schmidt, boasted in the Daily Telegraph that Google's tax scheme is just pure capitalism and he's very proud of it. The EU have estimated that between 2013 and 2015, they've lost €4 trillion in tax that Google owed them. And if we ever needed an example that capitalism doesn't serve everyone equally and that big tech are benefiting from this and we need an international solution, it's the international failure that trillions upon trillions of pounds are not able to be redistributed in a world where 44% of the population live on less than £4 a day.
Okay, thank you, Toby. That's great insights there. Joe, I mean, in terms of moving away from what Pads and Toby have said and focusing on something which is similar, but Google and Facebook account for 80% of all digital advertising spend in the UK in the year 2019. The Competition and Markets Authority has argued that they should have the power to fine companies up to 10% of global turnover. So it's similar to what Toby was saying in terms of them evading taxation. How do you think the government should go about trying to ensure that there's more competition so that Facebook and Google don't monopolise the market? Or do you think that's a lost cause and now it's about how we go about trying to limit their influence?
I think it's... Oh, the echo's back. But I think the... I think the way around this is that what should happen is there needs to be deregulation in this kind of zone, because regulations serve for these companies to go and try and force out other startups and things like that, and buying kind of like things like, I think, like that, and they're being forced out. I do think that the way to get around this, is through deregulation, and if possible, we might need to break them up. I mean, I know that sounds really odd coming from a Tory, but I do think that I definitely think that it is a part of the liberal is being liberal is being anti-monopoly, because they don't serve society particularly well, especially in these cases, as we have seen, and the kind of awful things that we've seen in Australia, where emergency services Facebook has been shut. Some emergency services. Facebook has been shut down, and that we have seen kind of an important message just couldn't get out, and this is really worrying. And I do think that we need to have definitely a stronger code, and we might need basically a code or kind of a few kind of things that have to stick by to ensure that they like things like freedom of speech, and that they don't shut down these really vital messages that need to get out.
Thank you, Jay. Pads, just quickly, I want to get your viewpoint on terms of the competition. And the government has created a new digital markets unit within the government's competitions watchdog. What do you think about what Toby and Joe have touched upon it in terms of how we go about tackling Facebook's increasing hegemony in the media and in terms of their digital advertising? And do you think it is a lost cause, and that it's now about how we can seek to limit the ways in which Facebook and these big tech companies manage to avoid paying taxation and avoid the same kind of scrutiny which other companies which aren't technology-based also have to face?
Well, I think these big companies like Facebook, for example, but it didn't last forever. I think it's almost a case of natural selection. I think there will come a day when an alternative means of news distribution becomes available. And I think Facebook can't really expect to be dominant, perpetually, continuously. I think there's not too much we can do to stop that kind of corporatization. Companies. But I don't think it will necessarily always be the same company. I think it'll move, it'll be dynamic. If that makes sense.
Yeah, so I think what you're suggesting is gradually it'll be phased out when new companies come along.
Yeah, sorry, exactly.
A bit like how TikTok has taken off in terms of a lot more people using that now.
Yeah, exactly like that, yeah.
Yeah, okay. Let's move on now to speaking about discussing Keir Starmer and some of the things he's been talking about recently. So let's start with Toby on this one, as you're representing New York Labour Club. So firstly, do you think personally, obviously you're representing your own views here, do you think Sir Keir Starmer has done a good job up to this point in time?
I think when we look at this, it's defined by two things. Whether Keir Starmer wins elections and what Keir Starmer would do if he does win an election. And if you look at the first one, I think currently Starmer's done remarkably well in his electability. He's gone 11 points in the polls after 10 months as leader. He's clearly alleviated concerns about anti-Semitism without discussing the process he's taken. He's clearly set himself up as not a continuation of Corbynism by sacking Long Bailey and not allowing Corbyn to sit as a Labour MP. And that has probably increased his popularity. I think backing the Brexit deal was the right thing to do. It made logical sense. It made political sense because the electorate did vote to get Brexit done. Labour needed to respect that. But the second question is, I think, where people are struggling. Because what Starmer would do if he wins in 2024 is currently quite ambiguous. He was elected on 10 radical pledges. Economic justice, social justice, a Green New Deal, a human rights-based foreign policy. But this rhetoric has been found slightly waning, and I think part of that is due to COVID, but part of that is due to this media narrative that he's shifting inward. Because he was talking to Sienna Rogers and Labour List the other day, and he said he was a strong believer in Vote to 16. And a strong believer in scrapping tuition fees, which he called a priority. And that's massive, because tuition fees were introduced under New Labour, and Miliband campaigned to reduce them to New Labour levels. And Starmer's going one step further than that. Can anyone hear me?
Yeah.
Oh, cool. And I think it's just because the echo went or something. And I think if we lump New Labour and the Social Democrat Miliband as this pre-Corbyn clump, and Corbyn as this radical, I think Starmer probably sits between them.
Okay, thank you, Toby. And I mean, in terms of Keir Starmer's recent opposition, do you think it's been strong and aggressive enough? I mean, Starmer has wanted to try and come across as not constantly bashing the government whenever he has a chance to. But in terms of, I mean, you alluded to Hancock's the selection of PPI contracts earlier on in the show. And when asked whether Hancock should resign, he simply said, "I don't want to call for him to resign," which is in a very stark contrast to Jeremy Corbyn, who in the Commons called for him to resign. Do you think Starmer's being aggressive enough in terms of his approach to the Conservative Party and some of what looks like nepotism that is in its ranks?
Corbyn is able to be far more aggressive than Starmer is, because Corbyn has the freedom of being an MP, which is very different to being leader of the opposition. I think it would be a bit insane if Starmer started calling for the resignation of a health secretary during the worst pandemic we've seen for 300 years. But equally, Hancock has committed sackable offences, and we shouldn't be afraid to say that. If we look at some of the contracts, it absolutely stinks. Because if you look at Serco, which is the brother of former Tory MP Nicholas Soames, the CEO Rupert Soames, they were awarded a contract of £108 million. It wasn't put out to tender. If we look at Randox, a Conservative Party donor, who paid £100,000 a year to Tory MP Owen Paterson, they were awarded a contract of £347 million. 75% of those tests don't work. And we look at Test and Trace, we know that that's failing. We know £15 billion has been spent on that. And even Sunak is failing to disclose whether he is personally going to benefit from the Pfizer vaccine. I think Starmer could be bolder, and I think he's going to be bolder when this pandemic's over, but I think he's really concerned about playing politics with this, and I think, to Starmer's credit, he is providing constructive opposition. He's not providing opportunistic opposition.
And before we move on to Joe and Pat's, recent polling suggests that the Conservatives have received a vaccine bounce. So they're on 43%, according to polling conducted by ITV's Peston programme, and Labour on 38%. They've gone down by 3 percentage points. Do you think that that's worrying, or do you think that there shouldn't be cause for concern because he's still got a long way to go until the next general election?
I don't think it's cause for concern currently. I mean, Starmer's campaign is built on competence over incompetence, and largely that works because it's true, because he is hot on the detail, he is thoughtful and considered. And the problem vaccine-wise in this current polling is Johnson is looking competent, but thankfully, Johnson's also Johnson, and he is a fool, and he does embody everything that's wrong with modern politics. So there's going to be many more mistakes for Starmer to look like the sensible alternative. And I think if we look long-term, Starmer is going to do well in 2024, because there is a coalition of people who have been screwed over by austerity, and have had their communities screwed over by austerity, and they tried to blame it on the EU and they failed, and Starmer is going to offer that alternative. Austerity was a political choice, and in 2010, there were 80,000 people on food banks. In 2016, there were 1.6 million people on food banks. And it's scary when Joe says we can't spend more than we earn, and we're going to return to that form of austerity, because that's massively misunderstanding the role of the state. Osborne and Hunt tore apart our NHS for a decade. We're seeing the consequences, and we need to stand against this damaging ideology, and we need to do it boldly. And I think when Starmer's given the space to say that, and the space to be bold, and the space to be radical, I think that's really going to connect with people.
Okay, thank you, Toby. Let's go to Joe. Joe, I understand you're coming from this from a very different position, being a Conservative. So do you think, how would you rate Sir Keir Starmer's performance up to this point in time?
I believe that... if Keir Starmer's elected in 2024, I'll obviously be disappointed, but I won't be scared like I was with Jeremy Corbyn. I'll put it that way. I think he's been very good in the pandemic, for the most part. Obviously, he made some mistakes. I think he could be bolder at the moment in his criticism of Matt Hancock. I mean, if you look at what happened with New Zealand when their health minister resigned because he broke the law, I do think that something similar could happen here. And I think he probably should put a bit more pressure, but I think he has been good, because at times in this pandemic, if you criticise too much, it could have incredibly adverse reactions to it. I think that for the most part he has been good. Where he's been found wanting, I think is a lack of personality. I don't think we've got his personality hasn't come across yet. He's just kind of, I mean, they used to call Stalin this, but I'm not in any way saying that they're any way similar. But he's a grey blur. Colonel Card Index. He's not the most exciting
Do you think? Are you saying part of the problem is you don't know what he stands for as a political
exactly.
Corbyn?
One of the most characteristic of Corbyn that was kind of quite vaguely malleable is you knew where he stood on things. I mean, I disagreed with the vast majority of them, but you at least you knew where he stood on certain issues. On things like on certain issues, for example, taxes and things like that. Where with Keir Starmer, I have no idea. I mean, we are a long way from the election, and I can see that. But I don't think it would be too harmful for him if I was in Labour's shoes to just start to draw up now and put in now policies for the next election that he can drum on about for the next 3 years and. Then can become more and more popular. Like obviously that's Labour's shoes.
I mean, do you think that'd be wise to do, considering that would give the policies a large amount of scrutiny?
I think that it'll be better if they were quite broad policies, maybe like increase taxes on the richest 1% or something like that. But we don't know he's going to do that yet, and I do think that would help. But obviously, this is coming from I'm an outsider looking inwards, and there's so many coalitions and factions in Labour. It's unbelievable coming from a party that, yeah, has a few factions here and there, but it's pretty kind of united at the moment. It's kind of it's very, very different. I accept that, but I do think that he needs to kind of have almost a base layer of policies set at the moment if he's wanting to really compete.
Yeah. Let's go to PADS now. PADS, I mean, being neither the Conservative or Labour affiliated, the Labour Party, I'd be interested to know what your viewpoint is on this issue. So far, do you think Starmer's done well as an opposition leader?
I think he's been good. Yeah, I think I think the role of the opposition is always a little bit different in a national crisis. I think they take not a reserved role, but more sort of a measured form of protest. I suppose we all kind of want the same things in a sense, like the opposition and the incumbent both want to see the virus end and the return to normality. So I suppose the role of the opposition now, which I think he has done to a certain extent, is to point out how he believes policy could be optimized, I suppose, to achieve that shared goal. I mean, for me personally, I think there'd be nothing worse for the opposition right now who just like latches onto every error by the government, sort of makes a big thing of it, because we've got enough to worry about. And I think it's counterproductive really to be too kind of vocal at a time like this.
Okay, and I mean, moving on to sort of the next thing, what did you make of the Starmer's proposal of recovery bonds? He spoke about setting up a new contract with the British people and was trying to play into the analogy of 1945 and Clement Attlee's reconstruction. Do you think that the idea of recovery bonds and setting up a bank for infrastructure is a good idea or not?
I think it's an interesting policy, yeah. I'm not an economist. I don't know about sort of I don't know how to sort of ascertain whether or not it would be a good idea in that sense, but to me it sounds like it's dynamic, isn't it? It's a proactive move, which I like. I think that's a good way of leading a country or proposing to lead a country.
And Starmer spoke about how for too long Labour has failed to realise that the only way to deliver social justice and equality is through a strong partnership with business. Do you think Starmer's trying to lead in the footsteps of Blair here? Is he trying to... Do you think one of the reasons why Starmer has made a statement such as this is because the Labour Party maybe believe that one of the reasons why they've lost elections so far in a row is due to this image of them being economically incompetent, financially incompetent?
It just sounds very Blairish, doesn't it? It sounds very sort of... like reactionary post-Corbyn to me. It just sounds like you say, yeah, just another step in his effort to shake off his image of economic incompetence.
Yeah.
But I do agree with the principle behind what he's saying.
Yeah.
But I think there was a political motive there as well.
Okay, let's go to Toby on this again. Toby, what do you make of Starmer's proposals he put forward for recovery bonds? And then he also mentioned business loans as well on top of that.
I'd have to disagree with that notion that that sounds like Blair. That sounds incredibly reminiscent of a McDonnell speech he made at the Labour Party conference in 2016. He made very similar noises to business. Businesses were quite a big fan of John McDonnell, they just weren't a fan of Jeremy Corbyn. I think Larry Elliott made the good point about these recovery bonds, that George Soros recently came up with a similar proposal for the EU, with the difference that governments would issue perpetual bonds on which the capital would never be repaid. And the start-up loans for 100,000 new businesses in combination with this recovery is pretty savvy economic policy too, because this would provide the security for savers whilst giving millions of people a proper stake in the Britain's future.
The start-up, loan's an extension, right, though, because they're already in place. So do you think Starmer, the reason Starmer included it is because he wants to expand the loans, give out more, make it more comprehensive? Do you think that's the thinking behind it?
I think so. And I think it links to a broader point which Starmer was trying to paint in that speech he gave. Because he said that inequality isn't just morally bankrupt, but amounts to economic stupidity. And to just focus on the moral bankruptcy there, over the last 11 years, we've seen 600,000 more children in relative poverty since 2010, and low-income families especially hit hard by austerity cuts, including the four-year benefit freeze and two-child limit, with £36 billion being taken out of the benefit system since 2010. And that's moral bankruptcy. So when we look at the 100,000 new businesses, we look at the recovery bonds, if they're trying to bring about a broader aim of inequality, any response to this austerity is good.
And, I mean, you mentioned McDonnell, and if I'm right in thinking, you correct me if I'm wrong, but McDonnell also put forward the idea of setting up a new bank for infrastructure. And then it seems that Starmer wants to avoid trying to alienate those who don't want to see higher taxes in terms of wealth taxes. So do you think you could say that Starmer is Corbyn dressed up in Blair's clothes? Or do you think Starmer has a distinctive ideology?
See, this is what I think is really interesting, because I think Starmer is trying to appeal to lots of different people at the same time, because he's trying to build that broad coalition. I think Corbyn had a really enthusiastic group of urban remainers, incredibly city-focused, incredibly left-wing, but Starmer is trying to build this broad coalition, and that includes socially conservative people in the Red Wall, who might be less economically left-wing and incredibly more right-wing when it looks to socially conservative things, but that also includes those urban remainers. So I think you're going to see policies of both, and he's going to try and bring them together in this unifying economic programme.
Okay, thank you, Toby. Let's go to Joe. Joe, what do you make of the proposals outlined in terms of the recovery bonds and setting up a bank to fund new infrastructure projects? Surely setting up a bank for new infrastructure projects isn't too dissimilar from some of the infrastructure projects which have been highlighted in the news recently that have been proposed by Johnson.
I think with infrastructure projects, what they need to do is create jobs, not in and of themselves. We shouldn't just pay people to dig a hole and then pay other people to fill it in. That's just stupid. As we see with Estonia in the last economic crisis, what they did was they put infrastructure in for businesses, for technology. And they did, yes, they did implement a form of austerity. And it was very, very biting and very, very hard. But the results were incredible. They were growing at 14% a year for a while and things like that. So, and it's not like their public services got worse either. They've got the third best education system in the world. They've got the best technological education system anywhere in the world. I mean, so to say that kind of they implemented austerity in a different way than we did and allowed the market to take over areas of the economy where it was really good and beneficial to do so. And I think that's what we need to do here. The other side effect of it is that not only did it massively increase wealth, poverty, I think, lowered or slightly raised, but that was because of a massive amount of kind of lots of people getting rich, and therefore kind of it was mainly actually old people going into poverty because they couldn't. I mean, I'm not saying that's a good thing, obviously it's not, but it was mainly kind of people because the younger people getting jobs and getting richer. But I do think with this sort of stuff, they massively improved their society without harming their children and their grandchildren, and that's what needs to be done here. And I think that, unfortunately, that's what Keir Starmer is proposing. And I do think it's just kind of a bit of a rehash of some of the old kind of... I think one of Osborne's policies was to set up those kind of bonds. So I don't think it's particularly kind of new or innovative. So, yeah.
Okay. Before we finish, I would just like to get thoughts from all of you on how you think the other parties are doing. So we have the Green Party, obviously, and the Liberal Democrats. So if we start with PADS, how do you think the other parties are doing? Are we seeing the sort of an entrenchment of a two-party system here? The Liberal Democrats have obviously fallen, and the Greens are still maintaining their one seat.
Yeah, I think at these sort of times, crises, it does expose the prevalence of a two-party system we have. I think the role really of smaller parties at a time like this is to act as, I suppose, in the same way as Labour does, like constructive opposition. But now is not really the time to be playing politics. I think now is, we have a shared, like I said before, we've got a shared objective. I think smaller parties need to get behind that to a certain extent. And
Okay. Thank you, Pads. Toby?
I think the Liberal Democrats with Ed Davey, I think them talking about carers and merging social care into the NHS is an incredibly powerful policy. I think if they can bang that drum, that could be really popular. I think Labour should definitely be listening to that and trying to incorporate that in. I think the Green Party are going to be incredibly important on putting pressure on the left if Starmer does shift to centre-lefty. I think lots of radicals in the Labour Party will be listening to the Greens and saying, look, we're going to lead if you don't listen to us. So they can definitely put some pressure on. I think the Conservative Party have had an awful pandemic, and I think there is kind of a consensus about that. But if the vaccine goes really well, and if people get incredibly hopeful about opening up and opening up goes well, I think they'll come out of it probably looking quite good as well. I think we might have a Thatcher after Falklands moment here.
Thank you, Toby. And Joe, finally?
I think the Lib Dems have kind of been swallowed by Labour and Starmer. I've spoken to some Lib Dem supporters, and they're saying, yeah, in the next election I'm voting Starmer. And I think that's probably a big problem, because I think he's eaten up that centre ground, and where he's gained is, I don't think, not with the Tories, is with kind of the Lib Dem supporters. I think there has been an entrenchment of the Tories with the working class of the North that we won in the last seat, even with that awful MRP poll that came out that showed that said that if there was an election, it was a few months ago now, Boris Johnson would lose his seat, but we still kept places like Bishop Auckland and Tony Blair's old seat. So I do think that those kind of working class areas are becoming more solidly Conservative. I don't see the Greens making massive gains, and I think that Labour has also kind of swallowed them up as well. Hence why Starmer is polling higher than Corbyn, but still not really reaching the levels that the Tories are at, and I don't think we'll see that. And I think because the vaccination policy has gone so well, and hopefully the... I think everyone will hope that the rolling out campaign, the getting out of lockdown campaign will also go really well. I think that will help the Tories into the future, and people will forget the mistakes that they have made in the pandemic and the errors. And I think that will probably lead them towards a kind of a similar, well, hopefully a similar result to the 2024 election.
Okay. Well, all is left to do now is I'd like to thank all my guests for coming on. I'd like to thank Toby, Joe and Pads. And thank you for listening and tuning in this evening. We will be back again next week and hopefully there'll be some new issues and it won't be so dominated by COVID, although that does tend to be the case these days, replacing Brexit. So thank you and good night.